You are listening to the Body Charge Podcast, and I'm your host, Sandy Sanderson. Welcome to the Body Charge Podcast. Today's topic is what causes the compulsion to hoard stuff and binge eat. Obsessive compulsive behaviors are rooted in a physical brain issue and therefore are not an archetypal psychological mental health issue. That is a big difference. All the talk therapies and pharmacological therapies of every type have not been able to address the underlying brain issue. However, there is a strategy that has been working to break such fixations in a groundbreaking trial. My special guest today is Jason Stanley, a social scientist who began research into the cause and cure of obesity with a medical anthropology field in 1979. Since then, he has published multiple articles, two books, and conducted multiple clinical trials. In early 2022, he began a 2+ year clinical trial based in neuroplasticity healing, the root cause of chronic emotional eating resulting in obesity. The success is a whopping 85% as compared to the standard long-term success of only 3%. That's a 97% failure for the standard ways to do it for the weight loss industry. So thank you very much for joining me on the Body Charge Podcast. I'm really, really happy to have you here, Jason, and really interested and so fascinated to learn about how you cracked the code or the way to understand how to solve this really quite common problem now. What sparked your interest in the field?
Well, back in 1979, and that tells the whole story in a way to answer your question. In 79, I needed to do a classroom project. I was in college. I was a little older student. I was returning from the Vietnam War, which it gives my age. And that's significant that I am so old that I was really lousy at library research. Now, that was before the internet, of course, so decades before it. So I went to my professor and said, hey, can I do a field study? And we were studying medical anthropology at the time. She says, yes, it's about the way you do it. It's not where you do it. So she allowed me to go forward, and I brought in, I advertised and got women, middle-aged women who were obese, had been obese all of their adult life, to talk to me. And they gave me their life story. And sometimes these interviews took 6 hours. So, you know, I really got into it and got understanding what the complexity and the emotional impact of being obese for an American woman. And what I found right away was everything that I had read was wrong. Everything. And this was like exciting. It's like, well, it's not diet. I had vegetarians. I had junk food junkies. I had everything imaginable in the study. It was not exercise. Most of the people were moms or grandmothers, and they had, you know, the normal life where they worked, what have you. One young lady was a graduate student. She ran over 5 miles every day. She's a long distance runner, and she was still medically obese, quite significantly obese. So it turned out that all the standard diet, exercise, those things had nothing to do with it. What I found was that there was a consistency in the patterning in childhood, the way they were raised. And this just set off all kinds of alarms. And I wrote it up and I gave it to my professors, and they got real excited about it. And they said, oh, you're onto something, you're onto something. And so that is what triggered that interest. Now, I didn't understand it at the time. I thought there was something going on in what we then called the subconscious brain. And because I took this idea to the psychology professors. I was at a university, and they said, okay, well, there's nothing we can do about it, because once you're through adolescence, at the latest, the brain is a brick. It's a brick. It doesn't change. You can't change anything in the brain after adolescence.
That sounds depressing.
Oh, my goodness, yes. And can you imagine what the message is to the people who had this? It's like, I'm sorry, you know, too bad. It's just you're going to be, you know, obese the rest of your life. Well, time changed, you know, over time. And I kind of just put it aside. I wrote a couple articles on it and put it aside and went on and had a life, got married, had kids, you know, the normal thing, went to work. But then about 20 years later, the culture had shifted and people were talking about reparent yourself, you know, change through forgiveness, these kinds of things. So I thought, well, okay, I knew it had, it was in the subconscious mind. I knew it was a compulsion. And that's what I wrote up in my earlier books, was it's compulsive. This is beyond addiction. It's compulsive. What does that really mean? And so I wrote a book on it because this idea, this cultural shift that you could repattern yourself. Well, I wrote the book and foolishly did that first, published the book. It was 250 pages, not like a pamphlet. It was a real book. And did the clinical trial, Sandy, abysmal failure.
Oh,
abysmal.
Wow.
You know, we were using forgiveness techniques on how to forgive yourself, et cetera. Well, it didn't work. So I thought, okay, well, I just don't have the answer. And 2006, 6 years later, I learned about a freedom, EFT, emotional freedom technique.
I've heard of that,
which is tapping.
Too. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so it's in the meridian points. Well, hey, in the meridian points, the acupuncture, there's a validity here. Let's try this. And it worked on me really well. I had a little bit of a weight issue myself. And so it worked on me. Great. So I wrote the book again, rewrote it, 350 pages. And I was living in Vietnam at the time, moved back to the United States and set up the clinical trial, and it failed. It was a 95% failure rate.
Again. Is it because everything was maybe too intellectual and not delving deeper into the emotional side?
Well, no, actually not, especially when I was doing the EFT. And I was really working, kind of straddling the idea that we are a physical, emotional, mental, and even spiritual being at all times. So I was dealing with people who were very spiritually oriented. And so they were bringing spirituality to the quest. And and then EFT is very emotional. That's the whole thing, is you bring up these old emotions. But what it is, what I found in 2020 was havening. And with the difference there is, now we call the havening. Yes. Havening is a technique. It's a therapy.
Mm-hmm.
And it deals with mostly trauma. It was developed and created for trauma. PTSD is a great example. And now, to get to your question about emotion, PTSD resides in the amygdala, which is a part of the brain, which is it's a part of the limbic system, colloquially called either the mammal brain, the mammalian brain, or the emotional brain. But it's not where your emotions, to say it's emotional is misleading. We have to deal with, not with the emotions, but we have to deal with the pathway, the neural pathway that's in this particular little tiny piece of the brain. And when you excite that pathway, then you're going to have some emotions. Watch when somebody who has PTSD get triggered, and they'll go through this extreme situation. Their anxiety shoots up, you know, right through the ceiling, and they're agitated and everything. And if they have a behavior that's connected to it, they can't not do that behavior. I like to use the Vietnam vet, because that was 50 years ago. And if it was Vietnam vet and the guy got PTSD when he was there, comes home, and it's been there, it's been patterned in his brain for all of his adult life. It never goes away. And so all of the emotions, these guys, trust me, I'm a Vietnam vet, these guys cry and carry on and hate themselves. And they are a basket full of emotions.
Yes, and that also is tied in with stress sensitivity. So they get triggered with tiny little stresses like other people can deal with quite easily. And funnily enough, it's also associated with very low magnesium levels in the body, because the body is always using up its magnesium to cope with stress. So we churn through our magnesium a lot. So there's this tie-in with low magnesium. And researchers have found that adding magnesium to diet and how you absorb it really does help to take the edge off that system, because it helps to calm the nervous system, the whole gastrointestinal system, and helps you sleep better at night. But what interests me a lot is that's a very physical thing. What mm-hmm. you're saying is that it's another physical side of the equation to deal with the amygdala. And my interest is, what function does the amygdala have in relation to emotions? So why do we get PTSD in the first place? And what role does the amygdala have in this process of dealing with trauma?
Oh, great. I'm so excited first that you mentioned the magnesium process, because I am unfortunately completely unaware, uneducated, ignorant, whatever word you want to use. So I really want to learn more about this. Now, the second part of your question is, what does the amygdala do? First of all, the amygdala is not an emotional part of the brain. What it is, think of a military fort. I'm going to just stay with the military kind of analogy. And you've got the soldier who's out at the front gate. They're the sentry. And their job is to look to see whatever's coming in. Is this safe or is it danger? Safe or danger? And it operates really, really fast. It operates at 1/4 the speed of the rest of your brain, meaning that if you walk around the corner and you see a rope or a hose on the ground, you jump back. Snake. And then you go, no, it's not a snake, that's a hose. So, well, that's
automatic
the
automatic reflex, is it?
Yes. Yeah,
the autonomic.
And that's the amygdala doing that. Yes, that automatic reflex. And so that's that safe or not. Now, when you have an emotion, any emotion, it's either a safe emotion or it's a danger emotion. So if I'm stressed because I'm nervous about being on the show, or if I'm stressed because my boss or, you know, the dog ate my homework, anything, that the amygdala says, uh-oh, you are in danger. That's the same kind of danger as if I see that the truck coming down the wrong lane on me, or the saber-toothed tiger. Any physical danger, the amygdala immediately goes to alert, or an emotional danger, amygdala goes immediately to alert. Now, what happens is, when that triggers, you've got that amygdala is going, now, here's a trigger. And so it's going to shoot down the pathway. So the pathway is simply a neuron, you know, the neural pathway, a neural pathway, and you've got a bazillion of them in your brain. But this one has been treated specially so that it always is there. Think of it like as what used to be a dirt road became a freeway.
A deep groove. And
think groove. Yeah. Exactly. Think groove. Exactly. So you've... In old terms, it would have been called a canalized pathway in the brain, like a canal, like the Erie Canal.
Yes.
So, yeah, so a groove is an excellent way to think of it. Now,
I'm like you, sorry to interrupt, but I thought of a record, you know, the old LPs with the groove and the needle.
Yes.
Follows the groove to play the music. So something gets stuck to do with the amygdala, where the memory or the issue keeps running over the same groove because it can't get past let's call it a scratch in the record, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right. And when they make the record, you know, the actual record doesn't have any music on it. It's all blank. And then when they press those old type of records, they somehow put the music in those grooves. And so that's what your amygdala, and actually your brain, the neurons in your brain are naive. They're blank. So any thought can go down back and forth. But what happens is, chemically, under certain circumstances, or in the PTSD, it has to be high stress, and there's a couple other things that have to happen.
Something
that
shocking.
That will create,
yep.
Pardon?
Something shocking.
Like, something shocking, yep, right. Yep. Right, exactly. And when it's shocking and you can't get away from it, it's circumstance. Those are the circumstances, then it literally wires the brain. It puts in a groove. So now it's chemically stationed there. It's always there, and it will be there for life. Just like the Vietnam veteran, when he gets triggered, our imaginary guy, when he gets triggered, he's going to climb to the top of the roof set up there with his gun for 48 hours, regardless of the circumstances and regardless of what it's the outcomes. His wife has already divorced him. His kids won't talk to him. He's going to lose his job. But he can't not do it.
So that causes the obsession. The obsession is connected with the survival instinct.
Yes.
And it's so automatic and so strong, and it's driven by emotions, right? The emotions are energy in motion. It's very strong. It gives us a lot of energy.
You have a ton of energy and is driven by fear, and it's the which is an emotion, yes. And you have to go to this place to get safe.
Right.
Now, there's no safety up on the roof with your guns, but he has to do it because that's what his pathway has told him. And now where we get into my work is we see that this thing that happens in the brain as an adult, PTSD, that's in my hypothesis. Now, I'm out here on a limb, so I'm going to be real, real clear. There's no science behind this. This is a hypothesis that supports the data. And I've got 44 years of data, but it supports it. It's the only one that fits it so far, is that this process of making this groove in the brain, it's called a potentiated pathway, a permanent potentiated neural pathway. That's the technical term for it. Occurs naturally in a healthy developing childhood brain. And so what we are given, not as the negative, like a fear-based situation, the trauma in PTSD, but we're built on the opposite side of what is good to us. What are we consistently reinforced as a positive thing? And in my work, it turns out that children who in the family, whether it's a delightful family or a horrible family, where somehow the mechanism is that they are consistently, reliably given the message that they are at the very minimum accepted while eating, and at the top end, truly loved and cherished and joyful while
eating. The reward
eating.
Mechanism. So they were rewarded.
Yes, but they're rewarded with acceptance.
Right. So they love me because I'm eating my dinner.
Or you clean your plate.
Yes.
Or dinner time just happens to be the happiest time of the day every day. Or any number of things. Yes, exactly.
So that sets up a deep groove in the amygdala. Yeah.
Yes.
And then they keep repeating whenever they encounter stress. Is that right? In
yes.
their later years?
Exactly.
It's a way
yes.
of coping with stress because they go back to that good feeling of when I eat, I'm accepted and I'm loved.
Yes, yes, exactly. So the stress, now the thing of it is, see, the amygdala has no language. It doesn't understand English any better than it does Chinese. It doesn't, no language at all. It's simply binary. This is stressful or it's safety. It's danger or safety, not stressful, but danger or safety.
Mm-hmm.
So any danger, which as an adult stress is interpreted as a danger, and you're going down that potentiated pathway, and the behavior that was created as a child has to be. It's orders of magnitude stronger than compulsion, or excuse me, than addiction. Much, much stronger than addiction. So, you know, we talk about the reward thing. You there's a great thing that you bring up there. But in this case, it's stronger than just reward. But yes, it is.
So
yeah, absolutely.
How did you work out, once you understood, then you had this light bulb moment, how did you work out the trial that was so successful? Why was it different? And how did it overcome that issue of, you know, missing the mark before?
Right. Well, what we do in havening, and havening is a therapy. It's a type of therapy. And it's the process is you activate the pathway. Now, let's again go back to the stress or trauma. It's maybe easier to understand there. And you activate that pathway. You say, well, tell me about what happened when you got in the wreck and the car was rolling down the hill. And the person will, you know, their heart's beating and they're having a hard time catching the breath, and they'll tell you about it. And so you get a score, say, where are you on a 0 to 10, you know, score of anxiety? Well, I'm at an 8 or a 9. Now, okay, so we've got them, and by that kind of heart rate going, that high level of anxiety, we know that pathway, that memory is firing, it's shooting, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then we introduce what's called havening touch, which, now this is science. It's going to feel a little woo-woo, but it isn't at all. It's science. We stimulate the skin in very specific places, and it has a term, it's called gametic skin. You stimulate that by touch, and that creates a delta wave. It washes the brain with delta wave. Delta is the deepest sleep wave that we have. It's the slowest wave. So you stimulate across the forehead, on the cheeks, above the planes of the cheeks, outside of the arm, and the palms of the hand. And it might be helpful just for your audience to look at their own hand and notice that the skin on the palm is very different than the skin on the back of the hand. And now it feels different as well when you rub it. So what's going on when you stimulate this skin, it introduces delta wave. Now, that's what we use in havening predominantly. It's very easy to do. It's not disorienting. And the reason I mentioned disorienting, because there's another therapy called EMDR, and that's very strong. It's the recognized go-to therapy in the American Psychiatric Association for PTSD.
What does that stand process, for, EMDR?
It's like your eyes, eye movement. EM, D is desensitization, repatterning. So what you're doing is you're moving your, hold your head still, and you can try this right now. Hold your head still and then move your eyes all the way to the left and then all the way to the right, all the way to the left. It's really hard not to hold, move your head. So now most of your people, your listening audience will do that. And it's a little disorienting. It makes you a little dizzy. It's like, I don't want to do this. But when you do that, you are creating up to 30 times more delta wave than you naturally normally have. But when you rub your forehead with your fingertips and your cheeks, you're creating 90 times. It's just, there was about 20 years between the developments and a lot more was learned about the brain. So we can do this and it's not disorienting and we just rub this way. When we have that neural pathway activated, that memory activated. Now, in the case of my work, what we're doing is we're looking at, tell me about, you're a little girl. So let's say I'm talking to you. And I say, okay, you're a little girl between 5 and 10, and you're with your family at a holiday meal, a happy time. Now, you'll fill in the details. Now, at this point, I have you havening, right? You're doing the havening. You say, okay, well, I'm 7 years old and I'm with my mom and dad and my brother and we are at grandma's house. And oh, it smells so good. And we're at grandma's house. So you tell a little bit of the story, but I have you give the details. It's your memory. And then I say, okay, well, how do you feel? How do you feel right now? Oh, well, we're at the table. Grandpa's saying the blessing. How do you feel? I feel love. I feel warm. I feel seen. Okay, well, and I'm sitting next to my aunt and she always loves me. She always listens to me. Well, tell me how you feel. And so I continually bring back, how are they feeling? And the big ones that you hear a lot are, I feel seen. I feel heard. I feel safe. I feel loved. And these are the times that are big for these children. Now, you may have somebody who said, wait a minute, that's not an emotion. I know, but it's how the person feels. So we don't want to get into the distinction between what's a feeling and what's an emotion. Let that stuff go. That's for the academics. But here in the clinical world, we want to get the child or the memory of that childhood memory really going and getting that emotion. Now, what's happening here is that pathway is now activated. I am safe. I'm loved. I'm seen. I'm heard. And that's going on in this memory and all of the emotions. And people usually have their eyes closed and big smiles come on. But while they're doing the havening touch, this pathway, that is drenching that neural pathway with delta wave. And what's going on, the next piece is that when you introduce delta to an activated pathway, chemical processes occur inside the neuron. Without getting into too many details, what's going on is it activates certain salts in the down inside the individual little neuron, and they come up and they dissolve the proteins that have held open that portal. That pathway that was potentiated has got a portal that gets locked in place. So they dissolve that, it comes out, and now you have back to a very smooth surface on the receiver side of the neuron, and it's back to what we call a naive neuron.
How long does this
thoughts can just go up and down.
Yeah. How long does this process take for people on average?
On average, about 20 sessions.
Okay. It's not like an overnight thing from
one day to the
next.
Right. Now, if you research havening and just go on YouTube, what have you, people will say, oh my goodness, I got over this trauma that has just been killing me for decades. And within one, two, three sessions, it's gone. But that's because trauma is an event and it's created in a situation that's not normal. But childhood development goes on day after day after day from the age of 2 or 3 up until about age 12 when the brain is finished developing. Not mature, but finished developing. So you've got years of development. Now, I've had some people who have responded fully within 6 weeks, within 6 sessions. I do 1 session a week. So within 6 sessions, yeah. That's unusual. I'd like to say that was the way it was going to be, but about 20 is kind of where the most of the people, the big hump is when that happens.
Now, let's say, for instance, a child had a very terrible trauma, was in a car accident, lost a parent, was very traumatized by it. When you retrace that memory and they feel very anxious as an adult remembering that time, how do you use the havening and associate the touch then with the good feeling? How do you okay. cross over to that part?
You don't need to cross over to the good feeling. So that's an interesting perspective there. What you do with the child, the same as I would with an adult, is you have them bring up the fear, bring up that pathway. And then, so we say, okay, well, bring up, remember the accident, yes. And how are you feeling? I'm feeling terrible. I'm scared. Okay, now start havening, right? You start the havening, and then I will distract them. Say, okay, can you count by 2s all the way up to 25? I'm dealing with a young child. Now, if I'm dealing with an adult, I say, all right, count by 3s up to 50. So 3, 6, 9. Now work it backwards, and they'll have 47, 44. But the mind is distracted. Now, the value in that is there's no more pain. There's no more suffering. You're not in this traumatic place. But once you've activated the amygdala, by telling me about the accident and they're all that anxiety, it takes, depending on which research you read, between 7 and 15 minutes for that amygdala to completely calm down. So you have this time of distracting them. Tell me about your favorite place to take your dog for a walk, on the beach or the park. And so they're talking about this while they continue to do this, because that pathway remains activated. So they're not in the grip of the terror for 15 minutes while you're doing the session.
By distracting the intellect, you're taking the guard away from the door to the subconscious, and then you can create a more direct pathway along that subconscious groove, if you like, and resets. What you're able to do is reset an old memory, an association that caused the obsession with the food.
And I like your term reset. Yeah.
Or hoarding or anything that causes compulsions to do something.
Yes.
It's just a routine that someone picked up, almost like, it reminds me of autistic stimming, where they do a repetitive behavior to calm and soothe themselves down. It's similar, isn't it?
I'll bow to your judgment. I don't know anything about autism other than the spectrum.
That repetitive soothing physical thing that they do reconnects them with probably the amygdala, that emotional center, and associates it with I'm safe, I'm calm, it's all right. So they've learned to do this for themselves. It looks sometimes weird to neurotypicals, but as we understand the spectrum a little bit more, we understand a little bit more about ourselves, because, for instance, someone on the spectrum with autism might find it quite difficult to relay traumatic experiences, and the level of anxiety may become way too high. They may just have a meltdown. So I guess that relies a lot on the expertise of the practitioner helping them to go through this process. So we're nearing the end of our podcast, and there's so much more to cover. Obviously, we've just like skimmed across the surface.
But thank you for that.
That's all right. Just giving people a taster, I guess, to find out more. If they do want to learn more about what you do, where should they go?
Well, they should go to my website, and it's not just because it's the website, but on my website, there's a button. There's always buttons, right? There's a button that's for the free ebook. And I'm writing this book. I'm finishing up the study and then writing the book. But I have published a free ebook that anybody can get. And it's written, just the first 5 chapters in a very accessible way. So the science stuff that I've been talking about here is not in there, but it really kind of written so the average person can get it. It's free. Just push the button. It'll take you over to a place and send it to you. Got to have your email address so I can send it to you, but that's it. So yeah, go get the book and yes. Learn a little bit about it.
Yeah.
And
so
the
your
website.
Website is?
Yes. NeverGainTheWeightBack.com. Yeah. NeverGainTheWeightBack.com.
What a great name.
That's the joy. Yeah.
Yes. Very good. Because we need to really understand ourselves better. And if we tried, mm-hmm. we've been on the merry-go-round of diet after diet. It's a roller coaster and always it comes back to the same place and we can't seem to achieve, even though we're not overeating. There's all sorts of reasons why people, you know, reach a point where they get very exasperated and give up,
yes.
but they shouldn't give
yes.
up because there's always hope and we need to look after our body, which is the temple of the soul. And
yes.
otherwise we can't fulfill our mission on this planet, right?
That's right. I agree 100% on that. Absolutely.
Yeah.
What we've done with that yo-yo dieting is we've dealt with the symptom, not the cause.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
It's like taking aspirin for a broken arm. You deal with the symptom, the pain, but the arm stays broken.
That's it. Well, we're into finding the real solutions. And thank you again.
That's right.
I really appreciate this, a very informative podcast.
Well, thanks for having me. It's been a delight. Great thank questions.
Thank you. Take care.
Mm-hmm. Bye-bye.
I hope you like this conversation and will share it with others. Hear more from Body Charge on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, and wherever you get your podcasts. Subscribe to our newsletter to get updates on blogs, podcasts, videos, and magnesium special offers at electromagnesium.com.au. Relax, recharge, and recover.